Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 15, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We have today a full panel of esteemed experts on the line, including our moderator, Patricia Paoletta of Harris, Wiltshire & Grannis, LLP. She'll be introducing our speaker and our speakers and topic for today's program, so I'll yield the floor here. Ms. Paoletta, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Will. As Will mentioned, I'm a telecom lawyer. I've got a focus on international telecommunications, so I'm delighted to be moderating this panel on the international implications of the FCC's recent open internet order, which departed from its prior practice and adopted a new regulatory approach, which we'll get into. And the panel is going to talk about the international implications of that decision and the sort of global ripples of the FCC's open internet order. So we're very thrilled to have a very expert panel to help explore these international implications. So basically, we'll start with a little background on Title II. And Title II refers to the second act of the 1934 Communications Act. Yes, I said 34, so 41 years ago, which governs common carriers, which is a legal classification that goes back even further to railroads and toll roads. I mean, hundreds of years of common law, right? Think the King's Highway. So that's what we're talking about, an imposition of a very old legal structure on the internet. Classifying broadband access, as the FCC did earlier this year, as a common carrier service gives the FCC, or they took, I guess, that authority to do three basic things. One, require broadband access providers to actually provide service if they're requested, require them to interconnect with competing access providers, and the authority to regulate their practices, including rates they can charge. Now, the FCC did state in the 2015 order that it would forbear, you know, at least at this point, for the foreseeable future, from rate regulation. But certain advocacy groups are already calling on the FCC to regulate the prices of certain apps or, you know, services that they may provide by banning zero-rated or, you know, otherwise known as free apps that interest groups alleged discriminate against providers of other apps. So in an example of the international ripple effect of advocacy in different countries, we've already seen bans on zero rating, you know, it's a form of rate regulation in a number of countries so far. So our panel is going to explore these issues, and we'll start with Rod McDowell, who was an FCC commissioner, you know, in the minority when the FCC first adopted the open internet rules 5 years ago in December of 2010. And he was prescient enough to warn folks 5 years ago about the international implications of regulating the internet, which we're seeing play out. And just as a reminder, you know, politically to set the stage, in November of 2010, 5 years ago, Americans had voted Republicans in as the new majority in the House. And a month later, before that majority could assume its leadership and against its urgings, the FCC, led by President Obama's appointee, you know, adopted that first open internet order on a party line vote. Back to Rob. You know, before being an FCC commissioner, Rob was Assistant General Counsel at the Competitive Telecom Trade Association, known as CompTel. Rob is also currently a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute Center for the Economics of the Internet and a senior advisor at the investment banking firm of Berenson & Company. So perhaps he can share with us any impact on American competitiveness due to Title II regulation of the Internet. We'll next hear from David Reddle, who's Chief Counsel for Communications and Technology for the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which recently held a hearing on the investment impacts of common carrier regulation of the Internet. David can describe this committee's oversight of the administration's participation in, you know, in various international fora where internet regulation has been debated, you know, including at the 2012 World Conference on International Telecommunications that he attended, and where both he and then Commissioner McDowell warned the world against regulating the internet as a telecom service. David can also detail Congress's reaction to both open internet orders, you know, including the one from this year, where despite bills from both Democrat and Republican leaders over the years, the FCC reclassified broadband access as a common carrier service subject to Title II. Again, a little historical footnote in a variation of history repeating itself. Days after last year's election in November, when the Republicans won the majority in the Senate, and the House Republicans grew the majority, days after that historic election, the president went online to encourage his appointee at the FCC, Chairman Wheeler, to classify broadband access as a telecom service subject to Title II regulation. And despite earlier protestations from the FCC chairman that he would not do so, you know, a few months later, the FCC did issue that order that reclassified broadband access as Title II. Back on David, at the time of the first OpenNet Internet order, and 5 years ago, David was director of regulatory affairs at CTIA, which is the trade association for mobile broadband providers and vendors. So he can hopefully offer his insight and issues confronting network management of a wireless mobile network versus fixed wireline broadband access, and his insight on some of the interest groups' calls to regulate mobile apps. And of course, mobile apps has been an incredibly dynamic area of internet growth. So, there's a particular threat there. And then we will hear from Paul Brigner, who has the distinction of being both a lawyer, holding an MBA, and a software engineer. So he really knows a lot about the internet. Now he's designed some programs running over it. Paul is a co-convener of the Internet Policy Forum, which is the D.C. chapter of the Internet Society. And until recently, Paul served as the director of the North American Regional Bureau of the Internet Society. The Internet Society, which, like its namesake, is a international network, has consistently warned against overregulation of the Internet, particularly in international fora like the Internet Governance Forum and other fora that he'll get into. So he's really been at the forefront of these discussions, so we welcome his insight. And lastly, we'll hear from Roslyn Layton, who is a visiting fellow at American Enterprise Institute in its Center for Internet Communications and Technology Policy. Roslyn, who holds a PhD, has consulted for a number of leading consultancies, such as Strand Consult and Tata Consultancy Services. She is currently also a professor with the Center for Communications, Media, and Information Technology at Aalborg University in Denmark, where she has researched and written about the impact of zero rating bans in a number of countries that have imposed rate regulation on internet services. So she can tell us if all is rotten in the state of rate regulation. So without any further ado, I will turn it over to our panelists. So, Rob, if you could start us off with your opening thoughts.
Sure, and thank you so much, Tricia, and to the Federal Society for doing this. There's a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to try to be as brief as possible. And as a disclaimer, I'm not speaking on behalf of Wiley Ryan or any of its clients, but want to give everyone sort of a thumbnail sketch of some of the history here and what it means practically speaking. And we have a lot of terrific speakers, so I don't want to use up all the time. But happy to entertain questions as folks have them later in the call. As Tricia pointed out, this notion of net neutrality and what does it mean has been going on for well over a decade. The term is essentially an empty vessel into which people can create their own definitions that essentially translate into please regulate my arrival, but not... and my rival's running too fast, so please put some regulations on them. Under the guise of let's keep the internet free and open, and of course the only way to do that is by having more government regulation in this space. So if you look at the history of the internet, when it was sort of privatized in the mid-1990s, as it migrated further away from government control, that's when it started to proliferate explosively. and became what I and others have called the greatest deregulatory success story of all time. It really penetrated faster than any other disruptive technology in human history, precisely because there were not governmental barriers, there was no mother may I regulation, it was cheap and easy and quick to get to as quickly as the networks could be built to connect with people. And that's especially true of the mobile internet. So it was a bipartisan and also international consensus to keep the internet free from old-style phone regulations. That, as Tricia pointed out earlier, go back to like the regulation of canals and the King's Highway centuries ago, something called common carriage regulation. And that's what Title II is. And that Title II, as she also mentioned, was codified during the New Deal in 1934. And it essentially codified old common carriage rules where the government has, by some estimates, Title II has about 1,000 different requirements, but they regulate rates, terms, and conditions of network operators providing service. So the Clinton administration, rightfully, as the internet was being privatized in the mid-1990s, said, we're not going to put these old-style regulations on the internet. And it was President Clinton's FCC chairman, Bill Kennard, who presciently said that, quote, classifying internet access services as telecommunications services could have significant consequences for the global development of the internet, end quote. And he's actually the prescient one. All I did was echo him, Tricia, but thank you for all the accolades. That was in 1998. So they got it right. So it was a little odd there for a few years. Here I was, the free market conservative Republican commissioner in the FCC defending Clinton Gore administration policy, but they got it right and deserved the credit for it. And so what happened? Well, what happened was the rise of Silicon Valley and edge providers producing content and apps. And edge provider can be sort of, from an engineer's perspective, an inaccurate term. But nonetheless, those companies that want to distribute content and apps over other people's networks, wanting free carriage of it, or as close to the cost of zero as possible for their bits, their ones and zeros, to be carried about the internet. So, and certainly by late 2007, early 2008, during the Obama-Hillary Clinton campaign, that rivalry, is when things began to change. You know, we had bipartisan unanimous votes at the FCC in 05, 06, and 07, I think even in 08, classifying all forms of broadband as an information service. And that's a technical term, which means it's not going to be regulated like a phone company. Okay, so here we are after two court appeals. There was a 2008 order, which I dissented against, and a 2010 order, which I dissented against. Both of those actually avoided this triggering this Title II. And it wasn't until about 13 months ago when President Obama cut a YouTube video saying, I really want the FCC to invoke Title II, that's when it started to happen in real form. So here we are. The February order of this year came out. It's on appeal to D.C. Circuit, and full disclosure, Wiley Ryan is representing some parties in that, so I'm not speaking to that directly. But I think there are a number of problems with that order, and happy to get into that in Q&A before I completely kill the interest of the audience by droning on. But from an international perspective, what this does is, and I started writing about this really in 2008, but it starts when you classify information services as telecommunication services, it literally triggers existing treaty language, international treaty language, to treat the internet as a phone system. And what does that mean? Well, in the old days, actually even currently, but more so economically in the old days, if you were here in the United States and you called a foreign country, you paid a very high rate, primarily because of the termination charges, the charges that the foreign phone company would levy on your phone company to pass that call through to whoever the person in the foreign land was that you were calling. And these settlement rates were sky high, and they often went into the state treasuries of various countries. So that's one aspect of what can happen here. It also can trigger the International Telecommunication Union, about 150-year-old treaty-based organization out of Geneva that was originally set up to regulate international telegraph, with a PH, rates between countries, and to kind of give them a new mission in life. But more nefariously, and I'll sort of end on this, is that for years, literally China, Russia, Iran, and many of their client states have been building a movement at the ITU and at the UN itself to try to get more intergovernmental or international control, treaty control of the internet. They see it as the product of free market capitalism and especially American free market capitalism. There's a lot of money involved, certainly, whether you're Google or Apple and your $100 billion in cash that you have, they would like to see some of that distributed to government treasuries around the world. But also, they want to have choke points on the internet, regulatory choke points, and political cover to squelch political dissent and control speech. And this isn't just, black helicopter conspiracy theory. There are black and white proposals. There was one big treaty negotiation at the end of 2012 called the World Conference on International Telecommunications, the WICCT, as we called it, where a number of proposals were filed by countries, and some of the more egregious ones were not adopted, but after a hard vote where the U.S. almost lost on a couple of these things. So right now there is a meeting starting to convene in New York with the UN General Assembly called WISIS Plus 10, the World Summit on the Information Society plus 10 years. And they have a draft outcome document that includes a statement recognizing, quote, the importance of the ongoing dialogue on net neutrality and the open internet in the context of the information society, end quote. And there are a number of these international meetings every year, all the time, and some actually evolve into treaty language. And so this close call from 2012 will be revisited again as the Chinas and Russias and Irans of the world get more wise and start doing their whip counts a little bit better so that they can have a majority. Ultimately treaties have to be ratified by the United States Senate. But it can have a very disruptive effect on the internet itself. And instead of seeing it just click off one day, I think what it really does is it starts to slow down innovation and investment. And you'll see sort of a slow grinding descent into mediocrity and certainly a reduction of freedom of speech and commerce over the internet. Anyway, I've blathered on long enough. Happy to delve into any of these areas, but it's a very real issue. It's hard to tell the average person on the street how it's going to affect their daily lives because it seems to be, gradual and abstract in nature. But it is a huge issue because the internet is the most dynamic communications medium ever invented and is the best conduit to spread freedom and capitalism throughout the world. And that is definitely in danger. So with no further ado, Tricia, I'll yield back to you.
All right. Well, after that, that's kind of depressing, Rob, so I'm glad David, at least, is getting to head to a Christmas pageant with his son. So we'll, David, you'll have to bring it up a bit.
Well, I wish I could, Tricia, but I would start by certainly associating myself with everything that Rob just said. And thank you, Tricia, and the Federal Society for asking me to be on the call. I'm not sure I can improve on the background and sort of substantive narrative that Rob just gave. I mean, he hit the nail on the head, and frankly, at the risk of stealing his line, like he stole one from Chairman Kennard, I'll focus my comments on sort of the way that we're viewing this from the congressional perspective. As you mentioned, we've on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, we have spent the last 5 years, the last 4 years. Engaging in the international internet governance debate. Chairman Upton and Chairman Walden feel very strongly that the legislative branch has a role to play in looking at bolstering U.S. messages abroad, particularly when it comes to international commerce, which is really, the internet is one of the greatest engines of international commerce that's ever been invented. So we have a very strong role that we've been playing there, and the WICCT was the first place we really substantively engaged on the international stage. And to steal Rob's line, We are fighting against opponents who are persistent incrementalists. And I hope I did that justice, Rob. I believe that is a line you have used before.
I don't think I'm original, though, but thank you.
You can have the credit anyway. They are persistent incrementalists. And although the international crowd really dislikes it when I compare what they do to the legislative process in the United States Congress, they really have a lot in common. And the one thing that they have in common at their core is that while you can fight as many battles as you want on the substance of a proposal, the war is won or lost in the definition section. And in this case, we have been working internationally to keep the internet out of the hands of government and in the multi-stakeholder system, the system where private sector and users and others who are beneficiaries of the network effects of the internet have a say in its governance and not just government. And unfortunately, what happened at the Wicket is we saw that the world's governments didn't particularly care for that kind of bottom-up, grassroots governance structure and made a move to bring the internet under their control. And that move consisted primarily of definitional changes. You know, as Rob noted, there are a number of things in existing treaties that are triggered by something being considered telecommunications, or, you know, basically just like the old telephone network. And frankly, in a number of the states that we've been dealing with, they still haven't abandoned their legacy PTT, their legacy post-telephone and telegraph system, where the government is the one in the business of providing communications. So the economic and the political incentives for these governments to exercise more control of the internet is certainly there. At Wicket, we saw those definitions start to erode, and at least then we had the moral high ground and said what we're doing is consistent with U.S. domestic law. Fast forward to the plenipotentiary conference, the ITU plenipotentiary conference, which was held in Korea last year, and you find that we are again looking in an international forum, in this case the ITU, at the potential for there to be definitional changes that could be detrimental to the internet. The difference this time is we no longer had the moral high ground. We in the United States had already redefined the internet to be a telecommunications service. So when we showed up and said, no, ICT, you know, as the Europeans and others on the international stage like to call the internet and other computer technologies, ICT is different. They said, well, wait a minute, in your own country, you've defined it as telecommunications to serve your ends. So we found ourselves in a do as I say, not as I do arguing position, which is no place to try and negotiate. And so we ended up seeing more definitional issues slip at the plenty pot. So more of the ground that we had by saying the government shouldn't be the only ones involved, it should be more of a multi-stakeholder system, we lost in that fight. As Rob noted, we're now seeing it again at the WSIS Plus 10 that's currently happening in New York. You know, the UN General Assembly is currently considering language that talks about the international arena of governments being a place to have ongoing discussions on net neutrality. And as we have had number of resolutions in the committee on this issue, and we've been focusing on it for quite some time, we feel pretty strongly that promoting a multi-stakeholder system and strengthening that system is a better way for us to keep the internet the way it's been, an engine of growth, an engine of commerce, an engine of free speech, than by moving it into a system where the ITU and only governments have a say in the debate. It's troubling at best, and we're certainly going to continue to engage on this front, but until, frankly, the court case that's currently pending in the D.C. Circuit is resolved, and who knows if that will be resolved at the circuit level or if it will go further, it's hard to see this going anywhere other than being a continuing point of debate in the international community. With that, I'll let Roslyn take over with some of the finer international points.
Well, thank you very much, David. And since you mentioned the discussions at the IGF, and Paul's ready to speak anyway, but Paul, your thoughts?
Certainly. So just checking, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yes, so having been affiliated with the Internet Society for the last 4 years, the organization is very much a proponent of the multi-stakeholder model of the Internet and preserving the Internet model. And through the Internet Governance Forum, which was a multi-stakeholder meeting set up by the first WSIS meeting back 10 years ago and every year since then. You do discuss these internet policy issues. It's a very good, robust forum for discussing the policy issues. And I was just attending the recent Internet Governance Forum in Brazil, João Pessoa, Brazil, and the topic related to net neutrality focused extensively on this zero rating concept, which is a way that services like Facebook, Wikipedia, and Google have built special programs to provide basic services more broadly in developing markets. And the concern, as it was in many of the different discussion groups there at the IGF, was whether or not this leads to confusion about what the internet is, whether this leads to control of these developing markets by these entities that are providing service, and whether it's anti-competitive. And honestly, I think, just to be very candid, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself and not on behalf of the Internet Society here, my perspective about the general discussion going on at the IGF was that there was overwhelming concern about these services in the abstract. And I honestly think that's quite unfortunate, because in the abstract, you can certainly make up different scenarios where these services could work against the free market process. But as they are actually working, and I've also dealt with some of my Internet Society colleagues who have looked at these services very closely, they are designed in such a way to not actually be anti-competitive if you take a close look. You know, just for example, I can go through some of the characteristics of some of these apps. So the one that is probably the one you've heard of most often is from Facebook, that was referred to initially as internet.org, but has since been changed because of just general concerns about that name to Free Basics. It is Facebook's Free Basics. So just because it was called internet.org, people raised concerns because they felt that there would be concern about Facebook being confused with the general internet. So that has been addressed. But going down some of these lists of characteristics, and you can decide for yourself whether these are anti-competitive or not. So it's an app that runs on a smartphone, and it does not stop the installation of any other apps or of the browser on the smartphone. So it doesn't block access to the internet generally. So within this app, there's a Facebook Messenger, and there's just the Facebook app. There's also Wikipedia, job sites, Google search. There's information about health-related topics. There's no data charge for moving within the app. When you go outside of the app, however, there you do get warned that you are going to pay for that data unless you're on Wi-Fi. The service itself, as I've been told, it's a text-only service. So when you do click on a picture, you pay for the download. So it's a typical data charge that you would have to experience if you do that. And the whole program is, as I understand it, of limited time. So this is kind of like an introductory service that helps people understand what it might be like to be on these services on a regular basis and part of the internet ecosystem, and hopefully would lead them to experience the internet more broadly. So if you look at this type of service as not just in the abstract, but in the specific and in the way it's actually operating in these developing countries, I think it's more than likely, you know, not an anti-competitive approach, but an on-ramp to the internet, which does certainly benefit these entities that are providing the service. It's a network effect, and you want as many people on the network. But I think there's clearly nothing wrong with trying to build out the network, and that's good for the internet. So aside from the fact of what is actually happening in the specifics, I think the impression that I walked away with from the Internet Governance Forum was that most people aren't looking at the specifics, and they're talking about the abstract scenarios that might occur. And honestly, I think the chatter in the rooms was overwhelmingly negative against these types of zero rating services, which is of concern. So I think there's maybe we can talk about that a little more with some of the insight from the other panelists.
Well, certainly Roslyn has done a lot of research and has written a paper on some of the per results or of the research in terms of the impact of zero rating. So, Ed Roslyn, would you lead us through that?
Yes, thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent. So thank you again for the invitation. I'm a new FedSoc member. I just got my little membership card today, so I'm really excited to be part of the group. Yes, so wonderful. I really learned so much. You know, even just listening to our panelists here, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate. So primarily, my work at Aalborg University has been an effort over 3 years to test the FCC's virtuous circle. This is the sort of theoretical underpinning of why, at least why the FCC says net neutrality rules are needed. It's a sort of view that, you know, net neutrality creates a state of edge provider innovation and subsequent investment in broadband infrastructure. So the interesting thing, if you look at the literature on net neutrality, I can only find one empirical paper. It's overwhelmingly theoretical. It doesn't mean it's not quantitative, but you know, there's not a lot of work done about actually taking the theories and plugging in the real-world data. So that's primarily what I've tried to do. And so I've looked at the net neutrality rules around the world. There's almost 50 countries that are on track to make rules or have rules. And so that's, you know, compiling the statutes, studying them, how are they different, and, you know, seeing does net neutrality actually do what the policy says it's supposed to do. So the top line things which I have learned, which I'd like to share, is, you know, first of all, there's three legal instruments used to make rules around the world. So first of all, it's primarily legislative means. Most countries, of course, you've got the EU28 and all the nations in Latin America make net neutrality rules through legislative means. They either update their constitutions or their communication laws, and this is a democratic expression of the people. This fits very much with the Article I project of the Federalist Society, and this is how nations go about governing themselves. So what's interesting, when you look at these 50 countries, only the U.S. and Canada are attempting to make rules by creating them through telecom regulation. I think this goes fundamentally to this debate of this common law versus statutory law. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the life of law is not logic but experience, this sort of view that, you know, that the common law approach is better. What's interesting is the telecom approach FCC's taken has a lot of litigation, as you know, the 9 lawsuits, recent oral arguments. So at least from my perspective, when I look at these other countries, it's really inconsistent for the U.S. to say we're not going to make a legislative solution when almost every other country has decided that that's the way to go. Interestingly, Chile has litigated net neutrality for 5 years before people said this is enough. We're going to update the Communications Act via the Congress, and that's what they did. Now, there's one other set of countries which I think is very interesting, and these are countries that expressly did not want to make net neutrality, to do rules either through regulation or legislation, but to use a multi-stakeholder model. And those countries are Nordics, Japan, South Korea, Switzerland, and UK. Interestingly, Title II advocates have praised these countries for their broadband networks, but these are also the countries that did not want to make binding rules. And maybe for a variety of reasons, whether it's implicating treaty language, as Rob and David discussed. But interestingly, sort of for example, where I live in Denmark, there has been an operator-led code of conduct. In Sweden, the regulator said, you know, our transparency requirements are so high that now that we have to comply with the EU rules, it's a step backwards. So it's interesting that there's also this kind of, you know, just a few holdouts now where soft measures are still in place. And this is the interesting debate which was discussed about the legislative approach versus the multi-stakeholder approach and the pros and cons. So as Rob said, there's absolutely an empty vessel. Every country defines it differently, different provisions, different punishments, different enforcement, and what have you. And in terms of virtuous circle, you know, interesting what we see is with the maybe two small exceptions, that there's more concentration in the internet traffic than less. So the countries that have made hard net neutrality rules, like the Netherlands and Chile, have actually seen less edge provider innovation rather than more. And why should that be? Well, when you start to make rules about the partnerships that can be made, flexible pricing and so on, you make it harder for upstart companies or edge providers to get a foothold. It's very interesting that the only global app that's not American or Chinese is Spotify, a Swedish company. Spotify got around, got a lot of its revenue by working with telecom operators around the world, offering a premium version through billing. No price difference, but the billing and the marketing was conducted by the telecom operators. So if you're a startup company, those are two major expenses that you don't have to take on. So unfortunately, what net neutrality appears to do the opposite. It appears to strengthen the position and the power of the established edge providers to the detriment of the upstarts. So just to quickly discuss, if you want to read my paper on zero rating, it's at Social Science Research Network. I presented it at TPRC last year. But I looked at the countries, Chile, Netherlands, and Slovenia, all of which had net neutrality rules. And interestingly, talking about persistent incrementalism, even where then, so here's the other issue. Just because you make a hard net neutrality rule, it doesn't stop advocates from wanting to move the goalpost. They will consistently say, regulators aren't doing enough, legislators aren't doing enough, it's not strong enough, and so on. You need to keep banning certain things that are questionable. And so all of these three countries that were first movers and making hard laws, gee, shouldn't that be enough? No, it's not. Well, those three countries created bans by a single complaint from an advocacy organization. There was no record of consumers complaining about free apps or so forth. It was made by a net neutrality organization that didn't like that differential offers were in the marketplace, even one complaining that prices were too low. So what is the outcome here of these bans on zero rating? Well, it tends to restrict the ability of the third and fourth telecom operators, the small competitive carriers, if you will, to partner with local content providers to offer things. So just a specific example, if you look at Slovenia, you had a small operator, which is owned by a cable company, that had a zero-rated its customer service app, very similar to 800, classic 800 number, so that when you top up your mobile balance, you can just go online. It wasn't charged. It's a very minimal amount of data anyway, but you go online and do that. Well, that was banned by the regulator, and as a result, people had to call the call center unless they wanted to use their data to do so. So there was a five-fold increase in the traffic to the call center, so that operator had to double the staff in the call center. And, you know, this was kind of the point of the internet anyway, that you didn't have to use the phone to charge the mobile balance. So that was that's one of the things in Slovenia. The other thing that was banned was zero rating of Slovenian content providers offering, you know, alternatives to U.S. Content or maybe your larger European countries' content, and then a Slovenian cloud provider. So really not threats to the general ecosystem, be hard to argue. The Slovenian regulator, I'm sorry, the operators are suing the regulator specifically about this line of, there was removed in the statutes a line about price differentiation before the statute was promulgated. So in every country, there are these huge debates between the telecom regulator, the competition authority, who are kind of at loggerheads about whether differential pricing is competitive or not. Besides the fact that every single good or service we consume has some amount of flexible pricing associated with it. In any case, the other case you could look at was in the Netherlands, where you had Vodafone, which there is the number two mobile provider, did a deal with HBO Go. Even though HBO Go was zero rated, it never earned more than 3,000 users. So this was another thing that we showed was the critics of this say, oh, the zero-rated service becomes popular. In many cases, the zero-rated service never rises. Nothing you can do. There's so much competition for services in the marketplace and apps. They can't break in no matter what they do. So at any rate, Vodafone ended up getting a fine of 200,000 euros. This is more money than they ever earned from the offering of HBO Go. So You know, you can see some similar things to the Netherlands than in the U.S. The net neutrality is led by the Democratic Party of the Netherlands. You have a large presence of Netflix in the market that has been, that takes up, you know, 30% of the traffic, is very active in the policy debate. But I think the key thing in the Netherlands is since the net neutrality rule came into place, there's less Dutch edge providers than before. It's significantly fewer, you know, Dutch content and sort of individualized Dutch content providers or app providers than there were prior to 2012 when the rules were put in place. So, you know, just some top line rules. And I would just, the other thing I would say is what's going on is not so much that there's bad actors of telecom operators around the world, but there's just a coordinated transnational activism. Transnational movements have learned a lot over the last 20 years, various causes, global warming and WTO trade, what have you. So any new activity that they take up, they are extremely successful and can leverage the global networks, the open internet, which works so well, free tools and so on. So for example, when, you know, you can take a campaign that's invented in the United States, you call it savetheinternet.in for India, and overnight you can make the regulator capitulate with a million emails. So definitely the problems that we're facing in the United States, we're exporting those. We're exporting our activism and policy and so on for better or worse. And all the tools that we invented can be used for good or ill. So at any rate, I look forward to questions from the panel or sort of share my own questions. But at any rate, those are my thoughts.
Well, thank you very much, Rosalind. It's certainly refreshing to have some empirical research in this area, which, as you know, the earlier speakers have noted, has been lacking throughout the decade-long debate in the United States. But we do want to give an opportunity for folks who might be on the call to ask questions, so I will turn it back to Will.
All right. We'll now open the floor mode to questions. In a moment, we'll hear a prompt that will say, "The floor mode is on." After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Okay, again, if you'd like to ask a question, please do hit star and the pound key. We'll answer calls in the order that they are received. Looks like the audience is going to take a second to dial in with their questions here, so our lines are open. Ms. Paletta, if you'd want to continue with the discussion to see if anything comes to mind, I'll let you know when we have some questions from our audience.
Well, certainly, Rosalind mentioned the coordinated transactional activism, and I'd be interested in, that's not per se a legal issue, but I would be interested, you know, from the other speakers, you know, Paul, Rob, David, you know, have you seen incidences of this kind of transactional activism with one, you know, public interest group getting another one going, or the same actors playing in different fora?
Yeah, this is Rob, if I can kind of speak to that briefly, which is certainly the U.S.'s action by reversing itself, 180-degree flip on, you know, from going from saying no common carrier regulation on the Internet to, yes, common carrier regulation on the Internet. That basically says, to simplify it, more government intervention in this space is good, and you need to have more government intervention in order to advance certain public interest goals. And, you know, the definition of what's in the public interest varies wildly from here in the U.S. to, you know, what China or Saudi Arabia might think, right? So it's important to kind of note that what the FCC did was to give other countries political cover, to say, well, look, we have security issues, so we need to regulate spam. That's sort of a big Russia and China thing. China wanted all IP addresses, internet protocol addresses that you know, every device connected to the internet has, your computer, your smartphone, whatever. They want those addresses associated with people, a registration, basically. I wonder why they want that. So, you know, but all in the name of security for the network or to control spam or whatever the case might be. There are all sorts of pretexts and phony excuses for why you need more massive government intrusion. And I've actually had regulators from other countries talk to me at international conferences about the need for a global universal service fund, and that would be where the rich countries pay for developing countries' infrastructure, telecom infrastructure. So it'd be a big slush fund that flows to dictatorships, around the world. So there are a lot of disguises that the end of internet freedom can wear, that the opponents of internet freedom can wear. And it's always sold as being in the public good for the benefit of the people, just like the People's Republic of China. It's all about the people, right? So keep that in mind. Don't be duped by slick campaigns and slogans and arguments. Make sure you dig beneath the surface. But it's all about having more government control over the internet, and not just the network operations, but the content and speech as well.
I'd like to chime in as well, since David. I think one of the underlying assumptions, and Rob sort of points towards this, in the domestic net neutrality debate is that the government is always white hat. And when you look internationally, you can't always make that assumption. And unfortunately, the fact that we are making these decisions domestically here has real international implications, and the underlying set of facts simply isn't the same. And so, Rob, the examples he gave are right on point. There are certainly others that have come up in the last 3 years in terms of individual points of entry into a country for all data is another proposal that has been thrown out there, so that you have a literal gatekeeper in the form of one point of presence. These are natural consequences of having a debate where you equate IP networks with telephony.
Now, I wanted to follow up with Roslyn. In your paper, you do note that, in fact, one of the outcomes of net neutrality regulation, because of squeezing kind of the local content and the local edge providers, is to see a concentration of traffic to some of the big, the big U.S. websites like the Googles with, YouTube and Facebook with, Instagram and WhatsApp and, of course, Facebook itself. Obviously, that's probably an unintended consequence, but it seems to be, or would fuel then concerns like Rob just mentioned, about some regulators saying, well, gee, the U.S. should pay more since these companies are getting so rich. So, are folks engaged in this discussion? Are you getting a sense that this is also industrial policy to try to extract some earnings from U.S. companies?
I think it's an excellent question, and something I certainly would like to research more and sort of peeling the onion in my own research. I think David's comment about the white hat and black hat is absolutely true. And when you look at the world, the family of nations, you have, small European countries like Estonia or Denmark where there is a legitimate belief that, okay, we have this little language and we want to provide some services for our population. What do we do? That kind of view versus there is a question we would say, well, maybe in certain countries like India, for example, maybe we prefer that they use our search engines and not their own or what have you. So they're different. Not all the nations engaging in this debate have the same endowments, have the same interests or needs, and that's a challenge. So internet policy for them will implicate lots of these questions and concerns. There is more, I would say one of the difficulties I will find is for a lot of well-meaning politicians who really want to try to help their nations in develop their own digital economies, they are getting duped into this belief that, oh, let me just make net neutrality and everything will be magic. If that's the case, then everything should be Indian internet companies because they have all the engineers. To make an innovative economy takes so many kinds of investments across a range of assets. And if you look at innovation policy, all the things that you need to do, there's really a cop-out here that politicians are sort of selling the people, oh, this open internet, for any other kind of agenda items they may have, and not looking at issues about the education, the things in the marketplace to start a firm, ability to access capital, all those kinds of things that are necessary to create innovative economy. It's absolutely an issue in the digital single market. And so the EU, I just wanted to mention one other thing. The EU right now is kind of trying to have a sort of a bipolar approach where they're trying to keep folks happy. You know, so on the positive side for people who want net neutrality, you have all of the branches of government on agreeing, at least on paper. But in terms of the practice, the body of the European electronic communication regulators have sort of two people. They have the Norway and the UK, which are these two individuals at the different ends of the spectrum trying to maintain this, these two particular views. And it's a big deal for Europe because they want to have, you know, they want to, in many respects, they want to have European technology companies. They never really developed the IT companies the way the U.S. did. So will this policy achieve what they think? You know, I would say no, it's not. But that's what, you know, they're sort of selling to the populace. So it will, so anyway, we'll still continue to live with this for a while. I'm not sure if I answered the question, but to say it's an area for further research for sure.
And then Paul, you've obviously been discussing within IGF and other fora about the impacts of Europe's digital single market. Anything to add on sort of the effectiveness of their approaches?
Well, you know, they're going through a process of kind of collecting feedback on the digital single market proposal. I was recently involved with a workshop they had at the Washington, D.C. office of the European delegation, the commission there. And so I think if, you know, if people want to get involved in that process, it's important to do so now. I think that, you know, they are actively soliciting feedback. So if, you know, if there's anyone here that wants to get their voice in the mix, I would encourage them to do so. You know, I think maybe some of the others on the call follow this a little bit more closely, but I know that from the Internet Society perspective, we're very much focused on internet governance at the highest levels, which sometimes makes it difficult to take a very hard stand on some issues like net neutrality. But what we do take a very hard stand on is preserving the multi-stakeholder concepts and that framework for the internet. So, and I think it's pretty clear, you know, where that lands in most cases, and that kind of outlines where the organization I think has been for a very long time.
And play out this year, I mean, what are the various events happening on the calendar with respect to multi-stakeholder involvement in internet governance?
Oh, I think the biggest one that Rob referred to is kind of happening now with this WSIS Plus 10 high-level meeting, where there is going to be a determination about how the Internet Governance Forum will be renewed going forward. And that literally is kind of playing out over the past week and now. So I think that to check up on those issues in the very near future would be something that would be very good for the Federalist Society to consider doing, because it is, I think, critical that model be preserved for the internet, because it does bring in more voices and it keeps a very vibrant debate and keeps the internet keeps that multi-stakeholder nature of the internet in play.
And let me ask a flip question: Are there any instances, and this is to Roslyn or to anyone, where countries with, you know, relatively vibrant internet economies have taken a stance where they've refused to regulate their internet, providers within their jurisdiction, as a facilities-based telecommunications carrier? Are we seeing any positive examples? I mean, certainly, well, in a sad way, it's positive to have the data you're collecting of, you know, sort of the perils of rate regulation. But do we have any positive examples?
So I would like to give the positive example of Denmark, as one I know well, I mean, where you've actually had a dismantling of the telecom regulator. This was done in 2011 by the center-left government with the sort of idea that, there are a variety of reasons, but it was a kind of a view that there's not value added to the society by micromanaging networks, you know, that this can be done. So there was a telecom authority and the employees were rationalized across four different agencies. So what would have been if there was a sort of spectrum or any sort of telecom related things that had to be done has been subsumed into sort of a chamber of commerce, if you will. It's called a Danish Business Authority. And the country has largely moved to laissez-faire for the most part for telecommunications, which definitely has a lot of involvement of the government in a variety of sectors, but telecom, very little. There's no subsidies, almost very, very little in terms of broadband subsidies. So it's hands off to a large extent. There's high investment. In terms of net neutrality, nothing. There's no legal anything at all. The net neutrality rules, there was a code of conduct established by the Operators Association. They took the initiative on their own, set up their principles, which have, you know, they say to the consumer, we're guaranteeing you a level of quality. They set up their own things. They invited the regulator to join their forum. And you cannot, there's no, nothing on the books officially from the Danish government on this issue. Now, of course, the EU rules will come into effect next April, and that will now be the what the Danish government will have to stay with. They're not happy about it because they have so dismantled. They don't have these employees to do this. They don't want this extra job. They don't want to have these extra things because they've also updated their telecom laws are still in effect, but they've updated them now so that OTT is considered competition to telecom regulation. So that is an even more of an impetus to say that this sort of a no-touch approach is the laissez-faire approach is appropriate. So I think it's an interesting because it's a small country. ITU calls it the world's most digital nation. It unseated South Korea about a year or two ago. Not all is perfect in the state of Denmark, but definitely a lot of high investment, high adoption. Of course, this has a lot to do with, you know, the government digitized. So there were a number of things in the country to spur adoption of different services. High educated, well, relatively high income. So this is common things across the Nordic countries. But the interesting thing is, I find it's a great counterexample of a non-regulatory approach that can lead to success.
You know, I think that's a great example too. Yeah, David, I was going to turn to you to get your thoughts on that model.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of being a total homer, I think you'd be hard-pressed to do worse than the United States mobile broadband sector from 1993 until January of 2015. A model of what happens when the government has the humility to stand back and say, you know what, go get them, guys. Go invest. Go do what you need to do. Get things into the hands of our consumers. Wire up our country. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a better example than that. U.S. wired broadband isn't exactly a slouch either in that respect. You know, prior to these rules being adopted that assume that broadband providers must be up to no good, so we have to throw out there a general conduct standard that says, essentially, the FCC will know bad action when it sees it, so be on notice. Anything you do might someday be overturned by the FCC. You saw that these were industries, cable, telecom, wireless, that were willing to invest an obscene amount of money to build out an infrastructure in a country that doesn't have very high population density, like most of the countries that usually get lauded for their broadband deployment. You know, when you take into account how big this country is and how many redundant networks we have overlapping each other, it's a pretty staggering statistic. So you said at the risk of being a homer, I think you'd be hard-pressed to do better than the United States.
Yeah. Can I just add something? I want to echo everything that David said to just put it in perspective. You know, United States, we're 4.5% of the world's population. We've enjoyed about a quarter of the world's broadband investment for a decade. It's just, I mean, you know, when people say, you can understand why other countries want the largesse to go to them, because the large part is Americans have enjoyed this wave of investment. It is an obscene amount of money.
Well, Will, I think we might have to leave it there, except for I would just commend the Denmark model to Chairman Upton and Chairman Walden, David's bosses, when they consider FCC reform. So maybe they'll take a close look at that. Will, I will turn it to you since I know we have less than a minute left.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank everyone for speaking on the call, as well to our audience that was very engaged listening to this call, and they've stayed on the line the whole time but did not have any questions. That's all right, though. I hope that everyone will join us for our next Teleforum call Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. It's titled Case Study in Government Overreach, the LabMD Case, discussing the recent decision in LabMD's case against the FTC. But until that call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.